Sometimes one or two copies of a faulty gene cause a disease. Think Huntington's disease or cystic fibrosis. Finding those genes was relatively easy. One gene, one disease. But most diseases can't be pinned on a single gene. It's more likely that a number of genes contribute or at least make people more vulnerable. In those folks, environmental factors can trigger illness. Depression and other mental illnesses are thought to fit that profile. This week, a team of scientists reports that a common gene mutation helps predict whether people will become clinically depressed when faced with traumatic life events that life inevitably throws our way. For the rest of the hour, we'll talk about this study and what scientists are doing to identify the genes that contribute to depression. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now I'd like to introduce my guests for the rest of the hour. Daniel Weinberger is the chief of the Clinical Brain Disorders Branch at the National Institute of Mental Health of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. He joins me today by phone from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Weinberger.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Douglas Levinson is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Weinberger, we're talking about a study that appears in Science magazine this week that looked at some 850 people that were participating in a study in New Zealand. Tell me what these researchers were looking at and what they found.
Well, they were trying to understand a number of things that have been on the minds of people looking for genes and mental illnesses, particularly depression, by looking in a population. They picked a population in one of the islands in New Zealand that represented what scientists call an epidemiological sample, in that it was a population selected because they were all born within the same period of time, they all had a similar ethnic background, they represented the socioeconomic and cultural characteristics of this population in New Zealand, and they followed these people continuously, basically every 2 years, for about 25 years. And during this period, they followed them evaluating the experiences that impacted on them in their environment, for the most part health problems and difficulties related to job, relationships, family life, economics, etc. It was really a study about environmental factors related to health and development. And they also were interested in the possibility, which is what led to this paper, that a particular gene, which exists in two forms fairly commonly in human beings, might relate to the chances that somebody became depressed in the first 25 years of their life in this population. The gene had been of interest for researchers in psychiatric genetics, or genetics of mental disorders, for a number of years because the gene makes a protein called the serotonin transporter protein, which is the target that most common antidepressants drugs like Prozac focus on. So these drugs, these antidepressant drugs, are thought to work primarily because they interact with this protein. So this gene made the protein. And there had been rumors, not very conclusive, reports in the scientific literature that one form of the gene, which is found in about two-thirds of people, which is called the S form of the gene, for the short form of the gene, was associated with a greater likelihood that people might be depressed in their life or might have temperamental characteristics that were associated with being more prone to depression. But these were very inconsistent reports that most people didn't think represented any conclusive evidence. So what these investigators did was they took this gene, which had been an interest in the depression world for a long time now, for almost a decade, and they showed that individuals who carried this S form of the gene, if they experienced in their lives a significant number of environmental stressors, they were more likely to manifest depression after these stressful events than individuals who did not carry the S allele, the S form of the gene. And this indicated that having the S form of this very specific gene, which made the protein that drugs like Prozac latches onto, that having this form of the gene made individuals more likely to experience environmental stresses as something that led to depression than individuals who didn't have the gene. And what made the study important, other than the findings, was it provided hard scientific evidence for something which researchers and doctors have known for a long time, which is that different people seem to have different capacities to cruise through environmental adversity. Some people, we all know people who seem to collect adverse environmental experiences, but roll up their socks, pick themselves up off the ground, and keep going as if nothing happened. And there are other people who seem to have a very hard time not being floored, so to speak, psychologically or emotionally, by one or two serious disappointments.
I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, Dr. Douglas Levinson at the University of Pennsylvania in University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, what do you make of this? I mean, surely this can't be the whole story for the genetics of depression.
Well, sure. The authors of this paper make clear that the form of this particular gene people carried didn't predict very well who actually became depressed if you ignored the life events and the stress. And in fact, in the genetics literature, there's a number of studies on both sides of the question for depression, some studies suggesting some role for this gene, some small role in your vulnerability to depression, other studies saying not. And it'll probably take studies of larger numbers of people than we have in studies now to answer that question. These researchers are more raising the question of this gene sort of as a mediator, in the sense of, as Dan just said, if you have this form of the gene, are you more susceptible to the effects of stress, so you would have depression? I think, you know, on the one hand, their statistical results are not overwhelming, and they've done a lot of different tests, and it'd be very easy to kind of nitpick and say, well, you know, they haven't proven the point. I think in general, in this kind of genetics, it's hard enough to do what they've done. They've done a remarkable job of getting the sample of, you know, 900 children, people to participate in the study, and they've produced a pretty good finding, not overwhelmingly statistically significant, and now it's up to other people to try to replicate it. And fortunately, we have a number of large samples of subjects, both from developmental studies and from twin studies in the world, where this can be studied. And this paper represents a really nice marriage of the modern technologies of epidemiology and large-scale studies of people over time and modern genetic methods. So whether or not this finding is true, it's a great example of how to bring those technologies together, and I think other people will be able to test it and find out whether this specific hypothesis is true. This gene probably is not playing as big a role as maybe the paper would suggest, but we'll have to find out what other genes are involved and whether this one is one of the big ones or whether it's a more minor one. But it's a great first step.
Well, I want to ask you, if this is a gene that determines how you're going to respond to stress and maybe develop depression, do you think there are genes that say that if you inherit, will say you're going to get depression no matter what happens in your lifetime? I mean, or your likelihood of getting depression is increased no matter what happens?
Well, I think that the pattern of depression in families and the pattern of depression in pairs of twins, you know, has been shown to really strongly suggest that there pretty much have to be some genes which, acting together in some way, raise someone's risk of developing depression substantially. We have no way of knowing from those statistics whether there are, you know, some people in whom their depression is 90% genetically predetermined and other people 10%, or whether in most people who develop more severe depression it's kind of half and half, partly a genetic tendency and partially other factors. But I think the data are clear that there are going to be genes discovered which play some specific role in depression, and the question is what they are and how do they work together, and how that information will help us in the future.
We're talking about depression this hour on Talk of the Nation, and you're welcome to join us. Call 800-989-TALK. But for right now, we have to take a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. A brief program note, join host Neil Conan and guests on Monday in this hour for the latest news from Washington and Iraq. American soldiers face a guerrilla war, a governing council tries to take hold, and claims and counterclaims over weapons of mass destruction. That's next on Talk of the Nation. We're talking this hour about genes and depression. My guests are Douglas Levinson. He's at the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia, and Daniel Weinberger, chief of the Clinical Brain Disorders Branch at the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda. And let's go to some of our callers who want to join this discussion. Why don't we go to Chris in San Francisco? Welcome to the program.
Howdy. Yeah, just a couple of questions. You talked about whether a person may or may not have a certain gene, and I was just wondering what the test to determine that was. Is it a blood test? Is it a skin sample, DNA, or how do you look at your genes?
Dr. Weinberger?
Yeah, it's a blood test. It's done by extracting DNA from white blood cells.
Oh, okay. And another question, I was wondering, are genes written in stone from the beginning, or can an experience modify the gene itself? Or are you born with your genes and that's it?
Ooh, interesting question.
Well, we generally assume that the code of the gene, you know, how it's spelled, the sequence of letters that make up the gene is pretty much there from birth. It may well be that how the gene functionally is regulated, how you turn it on, how you turn it off, because genes don't just determine things that we inherit, they also determine how cells function. Genes are the blueprint for how a cell operates. So we do believe that some of that can vary throughout life. But the actual, whether you have an S allele in this study, that is an S form of the gene, or an L form of the gene, that fact is in your inheritance.
Dr. Levinson, did you want to add something to that?
No, okay. I agree.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
And I have one more, if I may.
Okay, sure.
If they have any comments about the controversy about the addictive qualities of the SSRIs. I know there's lawsuits now, and people claim they can't quit taking them. And any comment about that?
Maybe Dr. Levinson, you'd like to tackle that one.
I think it's pretty outside the issue of genetics, and you know, clinically, I don't think SSRIs show the properties of addictive drugs. No.
Okay, Dr. Weinberger, anything on that?
Well, I would agree. I think that they're probably separate phenomena. The difficulty of getting off a drug that may have beneficial effects may be a different problem than whether it's addicting in the traditional sense of the word, but I think that's still a debated subject.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Levinson.
If I could just make one comment about the first point that caller made, and this idea that, in theory, one could test for this genetic variation in this paper in blood, but I don't think there's any reason to do so outside of research. That is, I think that this kind of finding is nowhere near the level that would tell us that it would be of some personal or psychological or psychiatric importance to test individual people and say, now we can predict what you personally are going to do. This is a statistical finding, needs to be replicated. A lot more needs to be understood about this kind of phenomenon, and I don't think we're at the level of kind of asking people to go out and get genetic tests to understand, you know, how they're going to behave in the future.
Very good. Let's go to Dan in Shelby, Michigan. Welcome to the program.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
Good.
I have a question about something that was told to me. I went on SSRIs about a year ago, and I've actually just gotten off of them. And I can tell you that personally, I'm feeling better. The biggest thing that I noticed was that I wasn't interested in doing a lot of the things that I had been doing, and that was a major symptom. So I went on them, and I got very curious about, you know, just what we know about depression. The doctor was really able to tell me, kind of just give me a cloudy view of things. He said, we know that that your levels of serotonin are related to depression, but we're not really sure which causes which, if it was the low levels of serotonin or if it was the depression causing the low levels. And I was wondering if anything new has been found out about that, because it's always kind of greatly interested me.
Okay, maybe Dr. Weinberger, is that one you'd like to tackle?
Well, I think you've asked a very hot question in scientific research circles now. We've sort of had this suspicion for a long time that serotonin is an important chemical in mood and depression. And certainly the fact that drugs that act on serotonin would seem to support that view. We don't know exactly how serotonin plays a role in mood. We don't know if it's simply a matter of too much or too little. And the other thing we've learned now, and I think this is part of the new era of the molecular biology of medicine, is that the cells that use serotonin as a way of sending signals between cells treat serotonin as the tip of an iceberg of how cells operate when serotonin levels are changed. So we really don't know that depression, we suspect actually that depression is a much more complicated phenomenon involving multiple interactions between critical cells in the brain, how these cells adapt to changes in serotonin concentrations, and probably other chemical concentrations also. So it's likely, just like the gene, that serotonin is a way to open a door to understand probably much more complex biological phenomena. And it may be an important door to open, but it's unlikely to be the critical element in this complicated process of developing depression.
Okay, so basically they really just still know that it plays a role, but they don't have a really clear picture as to what's going on with it.
I think it's difficult to say more than that it plays a role, and it could be a very important clue, but it's not going to be the whole story.
Dan, thanks very much for your call. I'd like to turn back to Dr. Levinson for a second. You are in the process of gathering large numbers of families in order to search for specific genes that might be involved in depression. What's that process? Why do you need families, and how do you go about searching for the gene once you've got them?
Well, the steps involved in looking for genes that control a particular trait or illness starts with what's called a genetic linkage study, and that involves finding sets of families in which at least two people, and sometimes more people, have had the same problem. For example, a pair of siblings who've had the same problem during their life, could be more siblings or large numbers of relatives, and testing of several hundred DNA markers throughout the genome in those people, and looking for places in the genome where, more often than you expect by chance, the people who share the problem have inherited forms of genes from parents in that region more than you'd expect to happen just by the 50-50 chance of any one gene being passed on. And then that kind of study gives you a very broad clue that somewhere in some very broad region of a chromosome that might hold hundreds of genes, or even more than hundreds of genes, that there's likely to be at least one or more genes that are influencing that trait. Then there's another type of study that's used to try to narrow down which of those genes might be involved. So we're involved for depression in the first step. I would say, by the way, that you have to differentiate bipolar disorder or manic depression from major depression or unipolar depression. There've been a lot of studies of bipolar disorder that are proceeding and trying to get some of these answers. I've been involved with studies of unipolar or major depression, and there's a number of studies in the world that are trying to do this. The group that I've been working with in the United States has been collecting we'll have about 650 families by the end of the summer, and about 950 pairs of siblings with this problem. That's considered a pretty good number for this kind of study, and there are a number of other studies doing the same thing. So hopefully we'll have corroborative evidence, we hope, in the long run.
And you're still looking for families, or you've got all you need?
Well, actually, the study is probably in about its last month.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if anyone out there has experienced recurrent depression and has family members who have, or a sibling who has, we'd certainly be willing to try to squeeze them into the end of the study if they'd like to help. We'll take as many families as we can get.
Well, if you're interested, I should tell our listeners that there's a link to information to how to join the study on our website, www.sciencefriday.com. I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go back to the phones, and Bill from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Go ahead, you're on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Bill, are you there?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I got some static when you mentioned the name.
Okay.
Thanks very much for the program. I'm all ears. Including myself, 4 out of 5 members of my immediate family have had major psychiatric difficulties. I'm very glad in the last year I've gotten diagnosed correctly, not unipolar, but bipolar, and it's been a long road, let me just say that. What my question is, and what I'm interested about, is the role of, and whether there's research in this area, the role of non-pharmaceutical metabolic molecular factors, nutritional factors, in treating mental health. My oldest brother was treated with megavitamin orthomolecular therapy years ago. Who knew whether it helped? He was pretty severe. I'm aware that when I stay up on folic acid and eat lots of protein and other stuff, it helps. I know that all of us who have been involved in the looking at it for a while know that it's not as simple as, well, one factor causes one. It's not a one gene, one disease situation. I'm curious to know whether there's serious inquiry in this area about macromolecular nutritional factors along the lines of how mental illness manifests.
Okay, thanks for the question. Maybe Dr. Weinberger knows about any studies
like
that?
Well, I think it's a very timely question, and there's been a lot of discussion about the possibility that these kinds of approaches could have value. I know of two things that might be relevant. Firstly, the NIH has a new center now looking at alternative medical therapies, and they are very interested in some of the claims that have been made about these kinds of alternative medical treatments for mood disturbances. And I believe that there are now some major clinical trials either initiated or planned to address some of the most popular treatments that have been discussed as potential treatments for mood disorder. So that's one thing I think very concretely is happening. I think that scientists who may have, you know, looked down their noses at some of these notions have gotten a bit more open-minded about it, but they also make the point that all of these claims need to be subjected to a rigorous scientific objective test so that people are not encouraged to avoid treatments that clearly do work and pursue treatments that have not been shown in objective scientific studies to work. But I think the good news is not only that I think there's a more receptive notion about considering these alternative treatments, but there's now a center at NIH that is funding specifically studies to evaluate these.
Okay, I think we have time for one more quick question. Jill from Waco, Texas, can you ask your question really quickly?
Yes, I certainly can. I was wondering if this or any study has revealed the tendency of either allele for depression to be dominant or recessive, and I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks very much, Jill. What do you think, Dr. Weinberger?
Well, I think actually the data are very clear about, and this is actually true not just in this study but in all the prior studies of this effect, and that is that S allele seems to be a dominant effect, in that if you have either one or two of the S alleles, you seem to show the same results.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have this hour. I guess if you have the S allele, that probably means you ought to keep your eyes open for oncoming depression. But as Dr. Levinson has said during the hour, it's probably not that strong an effect yet. So we'll just have to leave it there. And I'd like to thank my guests this hour, Daniel Weinberger, chief of the Clinical Brain Disorders Branch at the National Institute of Mental Health of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Douglas Levinson, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philadelphia. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Earlier, we spoke with Isabel Cote from the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England, and John Ogden of the Florida Institute of Oceanography in St. Petersburg. This program is produced by Annette Heist, Adrian McDonald, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Bergquist is our director and web producer. Our interns are Annalise Strachan and Erica Holland. We had help today from engineer John Knapp in Philadelphia. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. For email, the address is scifry@npr.org. Ira Flato will be back next week. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.